Ostcast.
Wissenschaftliche Perspektiven von auf zu Osteuropa.
Welcome to the second episode of the Ostcast, our interdisciplinary podcast on research on Eastern Europe. We are three students at the University of Munich, Marta, Max and Georgi. Today's episode is moderated by
Marta
and Max.
Yeah, as we are all thinking about holidays right now, we thought it might be interesting to talk about tourism history. We would like to talk about the developments, goals and ideas of tourism in Central Eastern Europe and the Soviet Union. And we are doing this by taking an inner Eastern European view. So that means that we want to focus on tourism which took place in the Eastern European sphere and thereby exclude the tourism from Western Europe to Eastern Europe. And also the other way around. And by doing this, the focus will be on the differences and maybe also similarities between tourism under nationalism and tourism under socialism.
You may be wondering why we are talking in English. We are actually very happy to welcome one or in fact two international guests from London. Professor Diane Könker, currently the head of the School of Slavonic and East European Studies at the University College London, she is our expert on tourism in the Soviet Union. She published major works on this topic, like the monograph Club Red, Vacation, Travel and the Soviet Dream. She also is the co-editor of the book Tourism, about East European tourism under capitalism and socialism.
Our second guest today is Dr. Felix Jeschke, who is the coordinator of the master's program Eastern European Studies at the University of Munich. He studied at the School of Slavonic and East European Studies in London and received his PhD with a dissertation on railroad policy and nation building in interwar Czechoslovakia.
Thank you both so much for being here.
Thanks for having us.
At first, we would, as a short starter, like to ask you, what first made you interested in tourism history and why did you choose this field of research? Diane, maybe you want to start.
Sure. It's a pleasure to be with you, and I look forward to our conversations. I became interested in the history of Soviet tourism in a previous project on the history of Soviet printers, and I noticed that among the activities they were doing in the 1920s was joining an organization called the Society for Proletarian Tourism. So I filed that society away in my head, and my next project was going to be a history of everyday life in the Soviet Union, and I thought I would have one chapter on tourism. So I began my research on that chapter, and I discovered there was so much material and so much interesting comparative histories of tourism that I made the whole project on tourism, and I dropped everything else.
And Felix, what about you?
Well, my interest in tourism in Eastern Europe actually grew out of my PhD thesis, which you mentioned was about railway discourse in interwar Czechoslovakia. And I got interested in tourism by reading documents about people traveling through interwar Czechoslovakia and from interwar Czechoslovakia to other countries. And what I found particularly striking about these documents is the way you have simultaneously nationalist tropes and cosmopolitan tropes side by side. And I found this kind of tension between nationalism and cosmopolitanism, which seemed to be happening simultaneously and wasn't necessarily seen as a contradiction. I found this tension very interesting, and that's why I have been focusing on tourism history in the past.
Yeah, that's also a topic I guess we will talk a bit more in detail about during this podcast.
Also proletarian tourism.
Yeah, exactly. So you both already brought up some good points for this podcast. And thank you for sharing this with us. And now we would like to start with a more general approach towards tourism. So what do we actually mean when we talk about tourism? So I guess everybody of us has some picture of what tourism is in their head, but how is tourism... Like, how do people do research on tourism? How is tourism defined in tourism history? Perhaps, Diane, you can start by telling us whether there is something like a definition of tourism.
Yeah, I'll be happy to start. And I think in this case, the Soviet Union is somewhat peculiar in international terms in definitions of tourism. I think if we think globally, tourism grew out of travel culture. And traveling was something that aristocrats did, and tourism came to be some sort of degraded version of travel in the Grand Tour. But tourism, like travel, meant traveling around from place to place, looking at sites. But in the Soviet Union, and this came from Russian culture before that, there were really two types of leisure travel. One was tourism, or the tour, which was traveling from place to place. And this was akin to the Tour de France, which began as an artisan's journey around the country in order to learn skills. But tourism specifically means moving from place to place in order to accomplish something or see sights. Travel to one place was not called tourism, it was called vacation or rest. And the most common form before the revolution was going to health spas for a cure. But in Soviet times, there became two distinct types of leisure travel. One was tourism, traveling around from place to place, but the other one was going to a specific destination, whether a health spa or later a network of rest homes or holiday homes, and staying there. I think we also need to think in terms globally of again, the middle class and aristocratic versions of tourism. Henry James famously said that the tourist was vulgar and didn't really understand what they were seeing. But for the middle class, I think there is something educational and liberating about traveling from place to place and seeing. But I think, you know, maybe Felix has a different definition based on more Central European conceptions.
So as I understood it now, the difference between traveling and vacation is kind of important for doing research and tourism, right?
Yes.
Yeah, okay. What we also read in preparation for this podcast was German author and poet Enzensberger, because he wrote an article which was called Theory of Tourism. Felix, perhaps you could tell us, when he talks about the dialectic of tourism, what does he mean by that? How does he understand tourism?
Maybe I can start by coming back to something that Diane just said, or several things you've just mentioned about tourism being kind of being seen as a degraded version of travel culture. This nice Henry James quote you mentioned as of the vulgar tourists. I think this is kind of a theme that runs through the history of tourism, is a sense that tourism is in some way a worse version of traveling, a kind of a subpar version that is superficial and not as rich as traveling. And that also Hans Magnus Enzensberg in his Theory of Tourism takes kind of this approach. He quotes many examples of people seeing tourism as something not as good as traveling per se. And that's always connected to the theme of mass. So always tourism is always seen as something worse than traveling because it's done by because it's a mass social event. It's a kind of a mass thing done by masses. And this is also connected to this dialectic of tourism, which maybe you could call it like kind of dialectic of destruction, because he argues that basically the impulse of tourists to travel and to go to other places and experience other places is to reach some kind of authenticity and to see something real. But at the same time, because it's a mass thing, so many other people are also traveling to the same place, trying to see this real thing, this authentic thing. And because of that, this thing is never going to be accessible. It kind of destroys itself in the very act of being done. So I think this negative view of tourism runs throughout the history of tourism and is maybe also one of the reasons why tourism history is, especially with regard to Eastern Europe, is kind of a, you could call it a niche subject.
Okay, a niche subject, that's interesting, yeah, because we always think with Eastern Europe, we already have a niche, and now with tourism history in Eastern Europe, we have a niche more even. Okay, yeah, I think we can switch to the sources that people use in tourism history.
Yeah, I think we talked a little about when distinguishing the mass of tourism, like a mass phenomenon, or traveling like for individuals. And this maybe also mirrors in the sources for research on tourism history. But first, we would like to ask you, how do you work as a historian of tourism? What are your main sources? Maybe, Diane, you would like to start?
Yeah, sure. I think when I began, when I decided to work on this topic, I went to the card catalog of the Russian State Library and began to look and see what was listed under tourism. And the first thing I found were hundreds and hundreds of guidebooks, which listed tours, which listed itineraries. And guidebooks are for any tourism in any country, are a really important source, which they list what should be seen and how it should be seen. I think studying guidebooks is similar to studying museums in a way, and that somebody has decided what to privilege and what to prioritize, and one can analyze what the society at that time thought was important by looking at guidebooks. But of course, for historians, another important source is administrative sources, and that's what tends to survive in archives. So in archives, we have sources for the organization of a tourist industry, infrastructure, access, financing. But for me as a social historian, the most important source is accounts of tourists themselves. And I kept looking for these accounts. And these are the sources that convey the agency of the tourist. And I discovered that in the Soviet Union, there were tourist clubs. And the members of those clubs would write reports about their trips and file them with the tourist club so subsequent travelers could benefit from their experience and their advice. I could not find the sources of those reports. So I never did find those. But what I did find, again, in the Soviet archive, were reports of tourist travels abroad. Starting in the mid-1950s, Soviet citizens were able to travel in groups, mostly to Eastern Europe. Every group had to appoint a tour group leader, and that leader had to file a report with the trade union sponsor and with the KGB when they returned. There are hundreds and hundreds of these reports in the archives, and I found these were my golden source. The group leaders reported on good and bad behavior of the members of the group, on what they saw that they liked and what they complained about. Some were just very factual. We saw this, we thought the other thing. Some were quite opinionated, describing surprisingly hostile treatment when they got to Hungary after 1956. They couldn't understand why the Hungarian people didn't meet them with open arms. A big problem with the source, though, is how authentic or how genuine they can be, because they were written for the police audience. And so when somebody says, we didn't like being shown all the churches in Poland, were they saying that because that's what they were expected to write? Or did they really not like seeing the churches in Poland? This is a judgment call. I try to read between the lines, but I also believe that there were people who preferred to see factories and not churches. And we have to try to triangulate those attitudes with other things we know. But that's the source that gets me closest to the actual experience of travelers. So it's the one I rely on a lot.
But can you say then that there's a lack of personal insights in those travel accounts, especially in autocratic regimes as the Soviet Union was?
It takes hard historical work to try to verify that these can be genuine experiences, or one can qualify them by saying, if somebody wrote that I wanted to see more shoe factories, you know, are they saying that just because they're supposed to say that? Or do you know from other parts of Soviet life that people actually took pride in their occupations and their specializations and did want to see a shoe factory? Those things are somewhat more problematic when they say things that are definitely against the grain, when they say, report how the Czech or Slovak elevator operator refused to take the Soviet tourists upstairs. One can say they wouldn't have said that unless that really happened, because that was not necessarily something that their minders wanted to see. So I think you have to take those. There are some travel accounts that were published in memoirs and other things after the Soviet Union, and those are all memoirs are somewhat subjective, and one has to triangulate them as well. So I think what gives me confidence in these tourist reports was the sheer abundance of them and the variety of voices. So they weren't just all saying the same scripted thing. And it was in the differences that the individual personalities of some group leaders came out. If some of them just wrote, you know, on day one we saw this, on day two we saw that, that's not very interesting. But it's the ones that deviated from that script that I probably gave more credence to.
Maybe I can also say something about that, because one important source for my research has been, I mean, everything Diane just mentioned as well, but also in Interval Czechoslovakia, there was a lot of kind of advertising for tourist resorts. And I've worked with some sources on tourist resorts on the Eastern Adriatic that were targeted especially at Czechs, and in most cases were also owned by Czechs. And they, for example, a resort in Baška on Krk Island. And this resort took great pride in targeting everything towards a Czech audience and very much used national tropes in its advertising. And there's one advertising brochure that was published in Prague and was kind of very published in also in a great numbers and great print run. That collected quotations from guests who had stayed there, which is quite different, obviously, from what Diane just said, the kind of source Diane just mentioned. But in a sense, it's different in the sense that it had a very singular purpose. It was trying to portray this hotel as being obviously high quality and luxurious, but also targeted only at Czechs and kind of having Czech food, having Czech beer, Czech newspapers delivered with only a week delay and stuff like that. But at the same time, I mean, these motifs were repeated over and over again. I mean, one important point is obviously that it's quite difficult to find personal accounts in many cases in the archives. It's also in Interval Czechoslovakia, it's very difficult to kind of, I mean, you have to look especially for ego documents on travels to a certain place, which will not be in a singular archival collection in most cases. So often these ego documents, personal accounts, can also be found in published documents, which obviously they often have a political tendentiousness in some sense. They have a certain message they want to convey, but that doesn't mean that they're wrong. And especially in the Czechoslovak case, you can maybe perhaps more than in the Soviet case, you can compare the kind of message that's being conveyed in these quotes with other documents and other accounts of traveling to the Eastern Adriatic, which are very similar in most cases. It's really quite astonishing how much this kind of sense of traveling to Baška in the Eastern Adriatic was seen as a national an act of national pride.
Yeah, Felix, you just did perfectly come to the next topic we actually want to talk about, because as you said, there was always, or at least sometimes, a message people wanted to convey with their travel accounts, and this message sometimes was being proud of one's nation. So also when we read about some of the academic texts about tourism, there was this topic that appeared quite often, the connection between tourism and nation or state building. And that's also the thing we want to go into deeper now. So generally speaking, by nation building, we understand the construction of a national identity using the power of the state. And it definitely makes sense to start with Central Eastern Europe in this case. Before the First World War, the map of Europe was dominated by big European empires, for example, the Austro-Hungarian monarchy. And Karl Schlügel, a famous German historian with focus in Eastern Europe, writes in this context that through tourism, the former Austro-Hungarian monarchy grows together. Felix, perhaps you could tell us what he means by that. How does the concept of tourism fit to the concept of nation building that you also just mentioned when you talked about the travel accounts and sources?
Well, I mean, I would say that I think the point Schlögl is trying to make is rather not necessarily that tourism was contributing to nation building, but that it was contributing to building an empire, the Austro-Hungarian Empire, and that as the infrastructure of Austria-Hungary was being developed, or mainly the railway infrastructure in the 19th century, that also led to growth of tourism, and that led to people traveling around the empire. That in turn led to travel guides being published of the empire as a whole, and kind of created a sense of the empire belonging together, and that just wasn't there before that. I mean, obviously the empire was an empire before that, but just this kind of sense of it being a single state really developed during the 19th century and developed alongside of tourism. Of course, at the same time as this was happening, also national activists in the Habsburg Empire started discovering tourism as a means of strengthening their mission, strengthening a sense of nationhood or sense of various nationhoods in the empire, which were often contradictory. So, for example, in the Bohemian lands, the Czech and the German national activists started developing tourist routes or hiking paths in similar places and started trying to, or in the same place, and started trying to argue that this is a German place or this is a Czech place, and that tourists can explore these places as German or Czech. And if these places were multilingual, obviously then there was bound to be some conflict happening from there. And often for the local population living in these places, who at the time, to speak with Tara Zahra, were still very nationally indifferent and didn't really care very much if they were Czech or German, this also created movement in ideologies on the local level, and in time turned these Bohemians into Germans and Czechs. And tourism was definitely a factor in this development.
Yeah, as we talk now about the Habsburg Empire, so after the First World War, this empire didn't exist anymore, and those new nation states emerged. And especially, I guess, for those new nation states, tourism was especially important then?
It was indeed. I mean, it was problematic as well, because many of the new, all of the successor states of the Habsburg Empire inherited parts of the empire that weren't really connect, like the infrastructure that had been built for the Habsburg Empire obviously didn't fit Czechoslovakia or Poland or Romania or Hungary. So first of all, this kind of railway infrastructure and hotel infrastructure that had been built for with a Habsburg tourist in mind had to be adjusted to fit these new nation states. But of course, it was tourism was a very important industry, both in economic terms for the successor states, but also in ideological terms, aimed both at foreign markets and at domestic tourists, because now the state had the capacity to, or the states had the capacity to market their own country for their own nation, so to speak, and thereby this kind of tourist industry that before then had mainly been pushed by non-state actors, by activists, national activists, was to a large extent in many cases taken over by the state itself.
What about now the people who traveled abroad, who did not travel across their own country, but traveled to other nation states? Did the people who traveled abroad contradict actually the goals of tourism for the nation state?
I mean, that's a very difficult question. I think that's, I taught a seminar on tourism history in Eastern Europe last term, and we discussed this topic many times. If tourism is mainly kind of or contributes to a nationalist, inward-looking worldview that basically just is interested in what is ours and kind of rejects everything that lies outside, or if tourism, by contrast, is something that for its mere existence needs to be interested in the foreign and the other and in other places, And thereby is also something outward looking and something that actually connects nations and is transnational rather than being nationalist. And that's very difficult to say. I mean, that really, I think it depends on individual cases. I mean, obviously, you could say that to travel abroad is by definition a transnational act, something that connects. But at the same time, a traditional kind of rather pessimistic view of tourism would say, well, if you look at these, for example, the Czech tourists in the 20s, and probably many would say Czech tourists in 2020 go to Croatia and hardly ever meet any Croatians and just stay in these Czech hotels where they can have their Czech svíčková, have their Czech beer, read Czech newspapers, and basically just enjoy being at the seaside while having their comfortable surroundings. So I think it's very difficult to make a generalized comment on that.
Maybe there's an interesting similarity to the Soviet Union, like when we talk about goals and reality. In case of the Soviet Union, we cannot speak of a nation state, of course, but we see it as a confederation or union. Nevertheless, Diane, can the understanding of tourism as a nation-building project, can this be also applied to the Soviet Union?
No, I think absolutely it can be. I think, you know, tourism is a civic activity. It can happen from above or below. I'm reminded, growing up in the United States in the 1950s, that an advertising slogan was "See the USA in your Chevrolet." An automobile company was advertising the ability to travel the country, but it was the state that was developing a network of national parks that you could see in your Chevrolet. And similarly, I think the Soviet Union was trying to create a sense of citizenship and civic belonging to a socialist project, and very much using its resources to try to encourage people to explore the natural beauties of the Soviet Union, particularly in the 1930s, emphasizing the ethnic difference of the Soviet Union and how they could be brought together. The good Soviet tourist would bring culture to the more backward parts of the Soviet Union, presuming that the good Soviet tourist was coming from the center, and would have a sense of the geographic vastness, of the ethnographic and natural vastness of the country. This was very much emphasized over and over again in the propaganda and the guidebooks that were coming from the center. But I want to emphasize something that in a way contradicts this. It's one of the paradoxes, I think, of all tourism. At the same time, they were trying to develop a sense of national belonging in this new socialist project. A very important element of proletarian tourism was to develop people's habits of independence and small group cooperation, not making them just parts of a big whole, but also through tourism, through particularly adventure tourism, you become a hero of your own journey. And part of the essence of proletarian tourism was to teach people how to design their own routes, to carry out a project, to record their project, and thereby become sort of independently capable of appreciating the country. So by making strong independent individuals in this larger space, they're creating citizens worthy of the space, but also citizens that could be their own actors. And I think here we get some of the difference between vulgar tourism and pure tourism. So this small group tourist, the independent tourist, was the truly independent actor, and that was really how one should experience the nation. At the same time, the most popular form of touring in the Soviet Union was the package tour, where you signed up for an itinerary and you were carried along from place to place. Both types were able to experience the nation and experience economic development and the wonders of industrialization and hydroelectric dams. But the way they interpret it was maybe in different ways. One further, you know, complication of Soviet tourism, and I'm sure that this is true also in Eastern Europe with its regional differences, the idea of a supra-Soviet citizenship was often predicated on the superiority of Russian ethnicity. And we can see this particularly poignantly in the case of Georgia, where mountainous Georgia and Georgia with its seacoast was a very attractive destination for Russian tourists to go to. The Georgians wanted to develop their own tourist industry to inscribe Georgian mountains as Georgian, even if it was Soviet Georgian. And this led to a lot of conflict between the Russian tourists and the Georgian locals. The Russians came and thought they were bringing an alphabet to the Georgian people, not realizing the Georgian alphabet was older than the Cyrillic alphabet. And so we also see these kinds, you know, through tourism history, we can explore these ethnic tensions in a different way of looking at some of the national questions and questions of conflict as well.
You mentioned the proletarian tourism. The main goals of this tourism were so learning about the own countryside, about the own, maybe the own identity as Soviet citizen. Is it right in the understanding?
No, that's right. And it develops over time. I think in the 1930s, the emphasis was on learning about modern socialism. So if you look at the guidebooks and the tours, there was a whole series of industrial tourism, and you could sign up to go to visit textile factories in the central region. People actually didn't want to sign up for those. They were very unpopular. But, you know, of the highlights, Moscow was itinerary number one. Moscow is the center of the socialist nation. What did you see when you went to Moscow? You saw Red Square, you saw Lenin's tomb, the mausoleum, but you also saw the museums with Western culture and high culture, and you saw museums of science. So it was kind of a combination of all the things that socialism was enabling to kind of bring the Russian and other ethnic peoples into the modern world. By the 1950s, there's an even more emphasis on ethnicity in a way. There was the area of old medieval Russian churches around the center of Moscow was developed as a tourist destination called the Golden Ring. And this was designed to generate funds in order to restore these churches, to attract tourism. But there was also kind of the government was funding this as part of Soviet richness, but there was also a project of an increasingly kind of backward-looking Russian nationalist movement within the Soviet Union that was trying to restore a sense of Russian culture. You see this in food and other things as well. So there's, again, this tension between socialist cosmopolitanism and socialist nationalism, and then the conflicts among the various nationalisms within the socialist world. And that's something also that you see in Soviet tourists going abroad to Eastern Europe, as they're all socialists like us, they're fraternal socialist brothers, but they tend to notice more the differences than the commonalities.
Diane, perhaps you could also tell us a bit more about from where to where people traveled in the Soviet Union. So you already said that the good tourist actually comes from the center, but you also said that Moscow was one of the most famous destinations for tourists. So how were people traveling across this vast country?
Well, here we get kind of, we combine tourism and vacation travel together. By far the most popular destinations, both for tourists and for health travelers, was the Black Sea coast. People wanted to go to the coast for the sun and the sea and the just relaxing on the beach. Second most popular destination were the Caucasus Mountains for its wild beauty and a sense of rugged sublime. In many of these, many of the package tours would combine both. You'd sort of walk on foot. You'd hike from the high point of the Caucasus Mountains and end up in a week stay on the Black Sea beach. So most of the travelers were from the center, Leningrad, Moscow, and the other industrialized cities. But there was also a lot of, insofar as people traveled from other parts of the country, they had to go through Moscow in order to get to other places. And so Moscow became, you know, you'd spend a few days in Moscow as a tourist before going on to these other places. When international travel started in the 50s and 60s, all the tours started from Moscow. So if you wanted to go to Prague from Omsk in Siberia, you had to go through Moscow. And so by default, it became the kind of destination number one as well. But it was also promoted as someplace that all Soviet citizens should visit, just as Sochi was on the Black Sea coast. There was a slogan, everybody should visit Sochi if only once in their lives. And of course, Vladimir Putin visits every month or something like that. But it was an important marker of being, of Soviet ability to travel was Sochi itself.
Maybe I can make a little comparison on that with Interwar Czechoslovakia, because because I was talking before about travel tourism in the Habsburg Empire, and for Czechoslovakia, obviously the main thing that changed was the territory of the country. Suddenly, Slovakia and Carpathian Ruthenia was also within the ideology of Czechoslovakism, was seen to be, of course, part of the state, and was also seen to be part of the nation. Especially in the early 20s, or the whole 20s actually, travel to Slovakia and Carpathian Ruthenia experienced a huge boom from the Bohemian lands, especially from Prague. So also here, I can't say numbers exactly, but the large part of travelers would have come from the center of the state. And Slovakia and Ruthenia were kind of presented as in some way almost colonial places that now were under Czech rule, but at the same time they were described as inherent parts of the state. They were kind of always seen to be Czechoslovak in essence, and that's a very interesting kind of rhetoric that was used for these places, which are basically just incorporated into the national discourse on tourism and hadn't been part of it before 1918.
Okay, thanks a lot, Felix, for this comparison.
Maybe when we talk about infrastructure, one point to Czechoslovakia, what meant infrastructure when in Central Eastern Europe, especially when the empire collapsed, what does this mean for the infrastructure and the foundation for tourism?
Well, it meant that basically throughout the interwar period, for Czechoslovakia at least, and I'm sure that also counts for some other successor states of the Habsburgs, spent the largest, or the railway investment was the largest financial investment they carried out. There was a huge railway building boom in Czechoslovakia in the interwar period. In 1918, there was no transversal connection from west to east or east to west that ran the length of the country. There was no connection between Prague and Bratislava. So all these very concrete infrastructure had to be built first. And also there was a big problem that after 1918 that many of the traditional tourist destinations, especially the spas, Marienbad, Karlsbad, Marianske Lasnie, or Karlovy Vary, were still, or the hotels, the municipal administration was mainly German-speaking and also quite German nationalist, and they tried to hide the fact that, or tried to kind of suppress the fact that they were actually now in Czechoslovakia. So most of the advertising materials from the 20s from these places didn't state the name of the state that they were now in. So this was a big problem that Czechoslovakia had to face after 1918. This is also true for many of the spas in Slovakia, which were mainly Hungarian-speaking.
Okay, so now we have talked a little about the structural preconditions, but now we want to talk a little bit about the social dimensions of tourism. We referred earlier, or Diane, you referred to the individualistic aspect of tourists, of proletarian tourists, and on individualism and collectivism, you elaborate in your book, Club Red, the following, I quote, "Tourism and vacation policies and practices explicitly encourage the celebration of individual autonomy in a state founded on collectivist principles," quote end. So the tourism review ruptures between state principles and reality regarding this conflict between individualism and collectivism.
I mean, I think if you talk about who in the state chose to do tourism, In the end, it doesn't really come down to the kind of ideological project that statement suggests. And when I tried to look at who, in fact, was engaging in tourism, and this, even though the original Society for Proletarian Tourism was targeting workers, the people who actually did the traveling from the 1930s onward were the intellectuals, the intelligentsia, what we could call the new Soviet middle class, who were both inculcated in a kind of socialist collectivism, but were also pursuing these kinds of individualist goals. When Soviet sociologists began to do surveys in the 1960s, what they found was that workers, the proletarians that were maybe targeted from that society in the 30s, workers did not really want to be tourists. They preferred to spend their vacations on their own, going to hunting camps or fishing camps. They did not sign up for the package tours or the individual tours. But this kind of individual tourism, touring adventure tourism, was really the preserver of the Soviet intelligentsia, which was quite a huge group by the 1960s and 70s. So in social terms, tourism was really a kind of middle-class intellectual activity. The agricultural workers did not travel at all. They didn't have the means, and they didn't have the education or the desire to do that. A second social difference that I think is important and was certainly not emphasized by the Soviet tourism planners themselves was gender. And it turns out that men and women of the middle class, of the intelligentsia, tended to choose different tourist experiences. It was much more women who were likely to sign up for package tourism tours. And it was men who preferred to go off on their independent solo journeys or small group journeys when it comes to tourism. Both men and women equally liked to go to the health spas as their vacations. But that was a different thing. You might spend 2 weeks in Sochi as your vacation, but you wouldn't call that tourism. You might also take a two-week tourist trip somewhere else to the Caucasus. But what I found quite distinctive was this gender difference in who was signing up for these tourist trips.
Did this gender aspect also mirrored in traveling groups, like female travel groups and male travel groups, or how the gender aspect, how is it distinguished in tourism in the Soviet Union?
This is more self-selected, because the way you went on these tours was you just signed up, you had your factory buy a set of tickets to a tour, and you could sign up to them, yeah, your factory or your scientific institute, more likely. But it was just the vast proportion, the largest proportion of these voluntary tourists on the package tours were women. And there were even comments. I mean, and this somewhat different for trips abroad, because all tourists had to first be vetted by their trade union and party organizations. But there was some concern that there was an imbalance, and that, you know, there weren't enough Soviet men on these tour groups, so that the Soviet women in Prague and in Budapest were running off and getting having evenings out with local men, which they didn't like either. And then the final aspect about gender is it's clear from post-Soviet memoirs and oral histories that this kind of vacation travel was actually an important way for people to find mates. That you would, if you were young and unmarried, you know, signing up for a tour or going to a spa or a rest home was a way to meet somebody of the opposite sex and maybe start a permanent relationship.
You mentioned the means of traveling, and we wondered what role does affordability played in this? Like, was it in the Soviet Union affordable for every Soviet citizen to travel? Like,
so this is one of the, I think, the features of socialist leisure travel, is that the state paid for these opportunities. So through your trade union, and everybody belonged to one trade union or another, you were able to apply for basically free tourist package tours or tourist the vouchers to a health spa. And even if the problem was that there weren't enough of these to go around, so not everybody could get one of these or get one of these when they wanted to go. But even later on, when they tried to make these available for purchase, the state still subsidized 2/3 of the cost of the trip. So it was really quite affordable. And that's something that people, again, post 1991 remembered with great fondness was how easy it was for them to get around the country. So it was highly subsidized by the state. On the other hand, one reason it was affordable was because some of the accommodations and amenities were so minimal. The health spas were very highly medicalized and had a lot of medical personnel, but the tourist facilities were abysmal. There were hardly any hotels. So-called tourist bases consisted of tent camps with maybe one structure to provide food. But the standard of amenities was pretty rudimentary, which kept the cost down and it made it more democratic and available to more people.
You said it made it more democratic. Felix, how did the situation look like in the more or less democratic states in interwar time? So who could be a tourist in, for example, Czechoslovakia? And like, was tourism still a privilege or could everybody be a tourist?
I would say it was definitely still a privilege. There were some subsidies given by the state to touristic travel, but not in the way it was done in the Soviet Union or also in post 48 Czechoslovakia. And it was a middle class pursuit. If you, for example, look through the Lidové Noviny, the most important serious newspaper of the interwar period, in almost every edition there are many adverts for touristic trips or for hotels, often also abroad, and especially on the Adriatic. But it was definitely not something that industrial workers or agricultural workers could do on a regular basis or even at all. But the point of the democracy of tourists in the Soviet Union is quite interesting because in interwar Czechoslovakia, there was a strong sentiment that Czech travelers were different from other travelers by their democratic nature and by the fact that they didn't indulge in similar luxuries as Western Europeans, and that they're kind of this the inherent democracy of Czechs kind of shone through in the way they traveled. And for example, in this tourist resort in Baška that I mentioned before, which, as I said, was targeted exclusively at Czechs, it was very important for the owner to kind of to portray this resort as something, democratic and not luxurious. It wasn't a tent camp, it was an actual hotel. But it was very important that all the rooms were the same, that they all had the same furnishings. They weren't in any, they had just had simple beds and simple chairs and were supposed to show that there was this kind of egalitarian ethos behind it. That, and you can see that also in other Czech discourse about traveling. For example, recently there's a book published by Sarah Lemon on Czechs traveling abroad, Czechs traveling to outside of Europe. And also there was a very strong tendency for Czechs to see themselves as kind of second-class travelers. So between the first class, between the colonizers, between the British and the French, to a certain extent also the Germans, but obviously also not third class, not the indigenous people. But they were kind of very, very consciously rejected luxury hotels.
Okay, so you already mentioned now this difference between the Western kind of tourism and the Eastern European tourism. So perhaps we can draw here a connection to the topic of our last episode, where we talked about the term Eastern Europe and the academic debate about this term. Larry Wolf was one of the researchers who elaborated on this topic. To shortly recall, Wolf claimed that the understanding of a separated sphere of Eastern Europe was a historical invention of the Enlightenment in Western Europe. In this context, Wolf referred to Eastern Europe as a demi-Oriental other. By this, he meant that Eastern Europe was not as alien as the Orient, but also not as familiar as Western Europe. For West Europeans during the Enlightenment, Eastern Europe was then Europe, but in the meantime, also not Europe. When we prepared for this podcast, we found it quite interesting that Anne Gorsuch wrote in her article, which is called Time Travelers, that by traveling to Central Eastern Europe from the Soviet Union, Soviet citizens built up a demi-Sovietism image of Central Eastern Europe. Central Eastern Europe was then Soviet, but in the meantime, not Soviet. Diane, what's your opinion on that topic? Would you agree with her?
Well, I think Anne put it very well. She and I worked on the same sources, sometimes side by side, so I know what she was reading. And the Soviet citizens who went to Eastern Europe came both from a sense of superiority because they were the first socialist country, but they also recognized that Eastern and Central European socialist countries were in many respects more advanced than the Soviet ones, and partly because of their own experience. So again, I remember from one of these reports that the Soviet citizens didn't really know how to use a knife. They had never really eaten food that required them to cut their food with a fork and a knife, and they felt ashamed and backwards at this. There was a sense of pride in Russian culture, but there was also a sense that high culture was European culture, and that's what they were experiencing in Western Europe. So there is a sense of socialist superiority, but Enlightenment inferiority, which goes along with Russia's, you know, age-old sense of ambivalence about its being part of Europe or not being part of Europe. And within the Soviet Union, the most Europeanized parts, Estonia, Latvia, Lithuania, were also seen as kind of halfway houses. People would visit those republics as a little taste of the architecture and the culture of Western Europe that was both enticing but also a little bit frightening for them.
Maybe to conclude, or as a conclusion, we wanted to draw to the timeline to tourism nowadays in Eastern Europe. And yeah, as a last idea, we would like to bring up the phenomenon called dark tourism, which means travel to places connected with suffering and tragedy, like, for example, Auschwitz or Chernobyl. Yeah, this idea became popular in Eastern Europe, especially after 1991. And how this can maybe be related also to Larry Wolf regarding Eastern Europe as the dark side of Europe. Felix, maybe you?
Well, I mean, I think that definitely after 89, Western European tourism, or Western tourism in general in Eastern Europe, is kind of taken to extremes. On the one hand, there was an explosion of tourism to old towns in Eastern Europe, to Prague, to Krakow, to Tallinn, and to other places that I think at least partly were drawn by this search for something authentic in a different way than you could find in Western Europe. So there was, I think, a sense of underlying belief that because a place like Prague had been behind the Iron Curtain for 40 years, it kind of now was awakening from this slumber and had preserved its architectural heritage and stuff in a different way than Western European cities. And on the other hand, what you've mentioned, this dark tourism that's been happening in, especially in Eastern Europe. I'm sure there's some destinations that could be called dark tourism also elsewhere, but it is true, I think, that many of these places are associated with dark tourism, like Chernobyl, like Auschwitz, are in Eastern Europe and kind of, yeah, definitely still drive this idea of Eastern Europe being somehow the place where violence and happened in the past and where the place of darkness, in a sense.
We want to ask to summarize in the end, Diane, like in one, two sentences, what are the peculiarities of Eastern Europe tourism?
I think for the Soviet Union, the most enduring peculiarity is this distinction between tourist travel and travel to rest. And the idea of tourist travel has come to mean traveling in groups and following a specific itinerary, and that has come to be the Russian way of traveling. But for most people, what they want to do with their vacations is not sightsee, but just to go to a place on the Adriatic coast or the Mediterranean coast in Turkey and plop themselves down and enjoy themselves. So that distinction has remained for 100 years.
Felix, now you go. What are the peculiarities for you?
I mean, this obviously doesn't hold for the whole of Eastern Europe or the whole of East Central Europe, but definitely Czech tourism in the Interwar period and also before that, a great peculiarity was this the sense of Czech travelers being somehow more democratic than others, than Western Europeans, but also than other Eastern Europeans, kind of being more egalitarian. And this this kind of cliche was perpetuated in Czech tourism, but you can't generalize that for East Central Europe or Eastern Europe as a whole.
Okay, I guess by that we are at the end of the podcast. We hope that we could give an understanding of the different dimensions of tourism history. Thank you both, Diane and Felix, for talking with us and sharing your expertise. It was a great pleasure to have you here.
And of course, also thank you for listening to this podcast. We're looking forward to the next episode.